Welcome to Mashup Radio with Peter Biddle. Any tech, any topic.
Opinions expressed here and in any corresponding comments are the personal opinions of the original authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of Intel. All Intel names and trademarks are the property of Intel Corporation or its subsidiaries in the United States and other countries. Other names and brands may be claimed as the property of others.
All right, welcome to another episode of Mashup Radio, also known as Atom Mashing Radio. I am your host, Peter Biddle, also known as Obsessed, OBS3SD, on Twitter. And this show is in celebration of National Reading Month, which is March. We're almost out of March, and you may actually be hearing this show post-March, which I can only say is because we are all software people and software rarely ships on time. I have, for the first time ever in a Mashup Radio show, a panel of guests. I'm super excited. They're from a bunch of different really interesting areas related to National Reading Month. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce each guest with a very short introduction and give them a chance to just say hello. And then we'll dig right into the issues at hand and the stuff that we're going to cover in the show. So our first guest is a gentleman named Ajay Gadwani. He is the CEO of Farfaria, which is a started as a company called Intuary, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, and that you've grown from a two-person operation to over 300 contributors for popular children's books, and that you've been dubbed by as a darling of the media as the Netflix for children's books by USA Today. And welcome aboard.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, cool. The next guests that I'd like to introduce are from Moondrop Entertainment. Moondrop is a startup creating tablet applications to empower children to explore and connect with their world, which actually sounds like something that a lot of people are trying to do effectively in a lot of places, right? There's a lot of people trying to use tablet applications to empower doctors to explore and connect with their world and retirees, and it's a big, hard, and interesting place. And we have two guests from Moondrop. We have Anna Albir. You are CEO and co-founder, correct?
Yes, Peter. Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for coming aboard. And we have Kunal John, who is the CTO and another co-founder.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us, Peter. We're excited to be here.
Cool. And then last but not least, we have Jason DePero. Am I pronouncing your name right, Jason?
You are.
Okay. And you are the CPO, Chief Product Officer for Playtel. You are a San Francisco-based startup building applications for PlayPals of all ages. So it sounds like we'll learn more about it as we dig into it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Peter.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for coming on board. So let's start with a question for Ajay. It seems to me that your focus, if I were to break down the space all of you guys are involved in into some key pieces, one of the pieces would be storytelling, and it seems like that's a category that you're really that you guys are really focused on. Is that consistent with sort of how you view your role in the market and with Farfaria?
Yeah, absolutely. At Farfaria, you know, we look at the mission of the product and really of the company is to help create the perfect story time. And we think story time is this great little microcosm of an opportunity for kids to learn and to develop, you know, creativity and imagination, but also for parents and kids to bond together and really in the classroom as well, excuse me, for teachers and classrooms of kids to bond together. And we think stories are a great opportunity to reach children. So we're really excited about being in this space and attacking it the way we are.
And when you think about that, you've got great content, right? How important is it for great content to be presented in a way that's different than just a child reading a book? Is the teacher reading the book a key component? Is an audio of the author reading the book a key component? Is having the kids read the book out loud to each other? Is it parents? You know, what is it all the above? I mean, how important is that actual act of storytelling versus the simple ingestion of the story itself?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we think that it's sort of all of the above, that that our goal is to as I said before, to get parents and teachers with kids reading together, and so when I talk to parents about our product, many of them do read with their children and use Farfaria as sort of the way to do story time or bedtime reading. But other parents and even the same parents that do that bedtime reading, their kids will use Farfaria on their own. And what they'll do is they'll use our Read to Me feature, and it'll sometimes be lean, you know, sit back and relax and let Farfaria read to you. Other times it'll be more of a lean forward experience in which they're engaged with the reading and trying, and the kids will actually stop the page from reading at the end and then read it themselves and try to mimic what they heard. And this is great for developing reading skills. And so we feel like it really is about an all of the above option. And as we look to advance where we go with Farfaria, I think it's going to be more of that.
And is it machine reading, or is there a human reading every one of these stories?
They're human read. We work with voice actors to ensure that it's not even just human, but humans that have talent for reading stories, which is
right.
An ideal thing.
Right. Have you gotten Kate Redding on any of your books?
We don't have her yet, but I'd be excited if she'd reach
yeah.
out after this.
I'm a huge Audible fan. I've been an Audible member since the dawn of time, and Kate Redding is reading read the Furies of Calderon series, which is Pokemon meets the Lost Legion, written by Jim Butcher, and we're listening to it for like the fourth time now, in no small part because she's just such an amazing reader, and it completes the experience when you've got this incredible reading.
Yeah, there's no question. I'm a big This American Life fan, and just the way they tell stories, I could listen to the same episode multiple times as a result of this. People being intense about what they're talking about and you know, bringing it to life. And in that case, you don't need the pictures or anything, but it's great to have them both in Farfaria.
Right. All right, so one more question on the spot, and then we'll move on. What was your favorite, name one favorite, not the favorite, This American Life story?
Oh, I'm still really hooked on the one they just played about the Chicago schools, Harker. They did a two-part episode in depth about, it's sort of a downer, I guess, but a very serious problem with guns and violence in schools in inner-city Chicago. So really intense, really great storytelling as well.
Yeah, those social workers were amazing.
Yeah,
they were
tremendous.
They were like, man, boy, they are hardcore. I was really
yeah.
impressed with them. And do you tweet?
I do, yeah. I'm at Ajay Gadwani, if you can spell that. I'm amazed. That's AJAYGODHWANI. But also, we're at Farfaria on Twitter, so.
Okay. Also at Farfaria. All right, cool. All right, so switching gears for a second from the storytelling, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. We're going to switch over to Moondrop. And I couldn't help but notice that you guys, Anna, for example, you have a BS in physics and civil engineering from MIT. I have said repeatedly over and over again that some of the greatest architects and systems designers I've had the privilege of working with have come from non-computing systems backgrounds. A guy named Ted Keel, who used to work for me, who was a founder of the UW computing lab in the 50s, was a biologist and then a medical doctor. Paul England, the architect I had on Palladium, was a physicist. And so I'm wondering if I look at the way it looks like you balance things with Kunal, I'm wondering are you bringing a systems focus into what you're doing for Moondrop, right? And if so, can you tell me, you know, tell me about how viewing it as a system might change the way you think about doing this cool startup, this creating tablet applications to empower children to explore and connect with their world?
Sure. Well, you actually mentioned one of the reasons why I loved my undergrad degree, in particular physics, is everything is about defining and describing systems. And for Moondrop, I think this played a role when we were trying to define what is the network that is relevant for a child. And we developed Drop to empower children to connect in a very rich way with the closed network. And so we had to define, you know, who forms part of this network, parents, siblings, teachers, and what sort of interactions do they need. And in that respect, from a design perspective, I'd say that's a systems consideration. And then just I think that's probably the most important one. And then just when we develop Drop, we're constantly thinking about how to define the different interactions in terms of systems.
And Drop, help me understand a little bit. Drop it sounds like it's a combination of between my ability to draw and then drop my drawings to other people. Is that the...
That's exactly right. So what we were trying to answer with Drop was you draw and then what?
Right.
And we understand drawing as one of the earliest mechanisms that the children use to interpret and make sense of their world. I mean, they observe, they draw, and then they hear from adults or teachers how they did. And in the physical world, they're only hearing the feedback from their parents, who may be with them at home or from their teachers at school. But we know that there's a network that cares about them that might not be present next to them, like grandparents, aunts and uncles. So what we were trying to do with Drop was allow children to receive feedback from all the people that care about them and that want to give that feedback to them.
Right. And are you finding now that the feedback loop is something that children really, is that working?
We think it is. I mean, we've noticed that our average session length is 5 to 15 minutes, and during those, 30% of our users have 30% of our sessions are longer than 15 minutes. And during that, we think that part of the reason for that session length is that children are receiving feedback for their drawing. We've had hundreds of shares a day.
So you have hundreds of shares a day. 30% of them are greater than 15 minutes.
Yes.
What are your actives like? I mean, are kids using this once a week, once a month, every day?
Children and parents tend to use it more over the weekend.
Right.
This is what we've seen in our focus group. So yes, it's mostly focused on Friday to Sunday.
Right. A lot of times, you know, a lot of times systems can be described as the hard stuff that runs along beside the obvious stuff.
Uh-huh.
Are there any things that you guys are finding that you're having to tackle either technically or sociologically or from a business perspective that is the hard stuff that's sort of not obvious, you know, when people think about what Drop might do?
So I'm going to jump in here, Peter. First of all, I think that was a great question that you asked, because in my experience, you know, I was at Amazon before this, and in my experience as well, some of the best people I've worked with that come from systems backgrounds, you know, just a way to break things down into like a block level understanding. And I think that with Anna as well, the way she thinks about problems is very different from like how I, with a software engineering background, approach problems, which actually helps a lot. So great question. And to answer your question about, you know, essentially some of the harder problems that we face, I mean, our goal with Drop is really to make it so that, you know, sharing a drawing with someone is as simple as pushing it across the table, which the child does today. He draws something and wants to show mom, hey, mom, look what I drew. And then mom or dad gives them the feedback of, okay, this is great, you know, hey, how about you focus on this some more? And that that pushing across the table is something which, you know, is so natural in the real world, but there's a lot of, like in Drop, we leverage a lot of the cloud experiences to make that happen, because our pushing across the table isn't just within the app. It goes across email or across text message, and we actually build that closed-loop experience with each of them where you can respond to an email or respond to a text message or respond or collaborate on the drawing over the, you know, within the app to create what's seen as simple as a feedback loop in the real world, but it's technically more challenging than just that. So from a technological perspective, absolutely, we're doing some really good stuff with, building in the cloud and making an experience that's built to last in a way that's iterative and collaborative. And also from the sociological background, there's a lot of behavioral design that we're actually bringing into what we're doing. And you know, what we see, what users see right now on the surface is much of a drawing app, but there's a lot of ways we're thinking in which to make in the intangible tangible, which is, how close am I to grandma, even though she lives hundreds of miles away? How close am I to my aunt, even though she lives, far away from me? So regardless of, like, distance, place, or time, we're trying to create these experiences which can be quantified and really understood by the child as well as the other side, the parent or the aunt.
Right. So helping view closeness as a function of emotional intimacy and immediacy and the act of sharing rather than distance or time.
Exactly. And also, exactly, you said it exactly right. And also in a way which the child can understand, right? Because to the child, it still is something which is, I mean, he won't understand the number of chairs, but he'll understand, I'm this much closer to grandma if I can see it visually, for example.
Right. Right. Cool. So, Anna, do you use Twitter?
We both do, yes. We're at Drop It at Twitter.
It's go ahead.
Drop.
What was it? Drop.
Drop. DRAWP.it.
Okay.
IT. Okay. At Twitter.
Cool. Excellent. All right. So let's get to. John at Playtell. You are Chief Product Officer, and I noticed that you have a background in Apple and interaction design, and that you've worked on iWork and iLife and some of the early iPhone apps UIs. And so I'm interested in hearing from you about if we started out talking about sort of the notion of storytelling and interacting with the telling of a story. And then we talked about the notion of what are the systems kind of things and the systems approach to how do you fit things together. I want to hear from you about the design aspect, right? How do you design play? And is that something that can be designed effectively and well? So maybe you could just start there.
Sure, absolutely. I don't think my story is going to be all that unique. I'm sure that a lot of the other companies that we've talked to have probably done the things that I'm about to say, and I'm sure a lot of startups do this, but I really think it all begins with looking at how people actually interact and engage in the real world, to juxtapose that with, like, the digital world that we're crafting our experiences within, and then trying to bring some of that magic of the real world into these sort of digital paradigms and create these, sort of optimized for love and fun and engagement rather than sort of optimized for, like, productivity the way some of these devices that we use today kind of have been thinking traditionally. I think it all begins with, before we ever write a line of code, sitting down and watching how people take care of some action, like reading together, like how does a child and a parent read a story together, or like with the folks at Drop, how do people draw together, or, you know, how do kids and an adult, how do they kind of pass that piece of paper back and forth? So I think it all kind of begins with just observing and trying to figure out how do we replicate some of that magic and pull it into the digital world.
And have you guys come up with any sort of design rules? Like, okay, so based on what we're trying to do, we are trying to learn lessons from the way people interact in the real world and build a fun play, fun play instead of productivity into the products and the experiences that you're delivering. Are there any things that you're like, okay, you know, if you're going to try to tackle this space, you got to do, you know, one or more of these things, and for God's sake, don't do one of these things.
That's a great question. I don't know. Rules and design kind of don't always go hand in hand. I mean, if anything, I guess we would make these rules and guidelines just so that we can break them later. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to how we've approached this for kids applications, I think there's sort of this need for hiding little pieces of magic inside the application. I know I've mentioned this word magic several times now, and what I just mean by that is, like, what are some of these, like, novel interactions that are really just there to provide, like, some delight. They might not have any function at all, like just a little bit of animation or some noise, you know, some sound along the way. And I think all the, you know, everybody here in this call today, in this podcast, I think everybody kind of has that magic built into their app. So it's sort of a consistent theme that I think a lot of kids apps are pulling in to really drive that love and that interest and really owning and using an app and kind of ingraining it in our daily lives.
So unlike Michael Bay, you're not saying that you have to have an explosion every 7 minutes, an explosion of magic, but that that the act of having that as an event is something that is going to be engaging and delightful for kids.
Sure. Yeah, we don't want to make the kids go cross-eyed with explosions every few seconds, but I'm sure there's some balance to be stricken there.
Right. How do you feel about the label edutainment? Is that something that makes you like me break out in hives, or is that something you gleefully don?
Yeah, most buzzwords make me cringe, but I mean certainly it's sort of in the idea is. Its heart is in the right place, right? This idea that learning should be fun, and it always should be fun, right? I mean, really at the heart of I think, all of these games and these experiences that are kind of trying to drive a sense of, like, a love of reading and a love of learning, because that's really what everyone is trying to inspire with the applications that we're making in the App Store and for children in general, right? I mean, that's the most important thing is, like, let's help kids craft a love of reading and a love of learning so that they can succeed tomorrow.
Right.
And if edutainment is the buzzword we need to use to get that done, so be it.
Yeah, right. As long as it gets you done and doesn't sink the boat at the same time.
Sure. Sure.
And are you on Twitter?
I am. Playtel is on Twitter at Playtel, just at Playtel. And then I'm at Twitter at Jason DePerro, DePerro.
Yeah. All right, at Jason, DePerro. I was on at Peter N. Biddle and then realized that I was too verbose to suffer the punishment of having that many letters killing my retweets. So that's why I actually shrunk it to something nobody remembers, which is just fine. So we have this continuum. We have a focus on or thinking about the notion of the storytelling itself around replicating the act of storytelling. We have a look at how do we do interactive experiences that help replicate the simple act of sliding a drawing that you made across the table. And then we have a view into creating, you know, play, right? Books and games, and being focused on play. I want to look at for all of you, and I'll start from we'll start backwards. Jason, we'll go from you from the back to the front. Is there anything that you didn't know, you know, 4 years ago before you started in on this, that has been, you know, a really important lesson, something that turned out to be much easier than you thought it was going to be, or something that turned out to be much harder, or something you're like, oh, wow, we totally need to pivot this to do this other thing because we've learned something new?
Yeah, that's a good question. So
And sure, while I'll interrupt for just a sec so you can think about it longer, because it's a totally unfair question. And I'm going to ask everybody else this question so you can all think about it before I get to you.
I'm the guinea pig.
Yeah.
No, it's absolutely fine. I think that's great. So Playtel, so what we do is we connect families in real time, a real-time video chat application that allows them to co-play and co-read. So the idea is that, like, a grandparent and a young child could connect and have bedtime or playtime. And certainly we kind of focus on this grandparent piece, but we also try and connect, you know, young cousins and children that they play around. So it's sort of this, like, trite idea of it takes a whole village to raise a child, and increasingly a lot of our lives are in this digital realm. And early on, I think there definitely, like, parents were bristling about screen time, and they were considering it screen time when they first look at the app, because it's on the iPad, right? And anything with that's behind the screen counts as screen time. But as they actually connected with their family members, they began to think of it as like a phone call or something that didn't really count as screen time, communication time, which isn't really a thing. It's just sort of how they connect. So kind of getting over that hurdle has definitely been kind of something that we have definitely really started to try and focus our attention on, and making sure that we can not be associated with the time of, you know, the kid gets on the iPad every day or, you know, in front of the TV, but considered a part of some other experience. So that's been a kind of a big focus and kind of a gotcha that has certainly kind of opened our eyes to the ways families think about how they interact with one another.
Right. If we say that, I'll refer to that as dodging the screen time tax or screen time, you know, limitations. I'll just call it tax. It's easier.
Is that
you know, people view SpongeBob SquarePants, which I think has now been demonstrably proven to make us stupid, with your app, and that they're indistinguishable. It's just screen time.
I mean, that's the goal, right? It's like, how do we provide value in a kid's life? In such a way that they're not just, like, unblinkingly staring at SpongeBob, but, pausing and giving them space to think creatively and to create that love of learning and reading. And I think the things that provide that, they're educational, but they generally still count, right? It's not until we engage together, whether we're apart and we're engaging in, you know, a phone call or Skype or what have you, however you want to communicate with one another. It's like fostering those real deep and kind of interesting family bonds. That I think that's where we get away from it. It's not the content. I think it's more about the connecting that helps us avoid that tax. Yeah.
Right. Okay. All right. So next up, we're going up to Kunal and Anna, and we're asking you guys the same question, and that is, in your space, you know, is there something you know now about helping children connect that you didn't know before, or is there an assumption that you've had to challenge, or a thing you've had to stop doing that you thought was going to be good?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think I personally second some of the stuff that Jason said, which is if we're entering the space, there's almost a responsibility on us to make sure that what we do is inherently useful for the child in a way that the parent basically encourages the child to use the product more only because they see the value in it. And that's what drives me every day, to make sure that what we're building here is something which the parent and the child both have their own reasons to use. For example, with Drop, what we're doing is really trying to bring that natural learning experience to the product. So, you know, naturally how we get kids as well as adults learners, we understand the world as we see it, we express our understanding, and then we get some feedback as to, you know, whether what we did is right or wrong. taking that, you know, drawing is essentially the simplest and the thing that the child does first as they start growing up. And bringing that experience and simplifying it and really breaking it down to enhance it through the tablet makes it so that that feedback loop is something which now can be provided not just with the parent, but any person, as Jason said, involved in the child's life. And that feedback loop, I think, is something which, while we had it in our head when we started building this product, has been definitely challenging and interesting to keep simplifying to the point that, you know, it is as we describe it, just a simple swipe across the table. So, you know, we tried several different things to see where we could, you know, how we could essentially have a child share something and boiled it down to simple pinch and swipe, where the kid draws what they want and then essentially pinches the drawing and swipes it to a loved one. And I think that really breaking it down to something very literal, something which the kid can understand and then celebrate, is something which has been definitely a challenge and something which we're learning as we go along.
Cool.
Go ahead, Peter.
No, I was just gonna lead to you. So.
Well, I was gonna add to Kunal's point in that I think the way we've learned to adapt has also changed, and that has been a learning experience in and of itself. What I mean by that is, I think my personal impression of what the development process is has changed. For example, in civil engineering, projects take tens of years. In physics, sometimes you die and the project still has not ended. Same in business consulting, you work for a period of time and then it ends. And here, I would describe the development process more like a conversation with consumers. And so to hone in the feedback loops that Kunal was talking about, we shifted from longer development times. Now we aim to do a release, to submit a release each week. And we've also honed in the types of metrics that we use. And this shift from viewing ourselves as developing discrete apps towards one where we're talking with the consumers in a way and trying to hone into how we listen to what they're saying and what they like and what they don't like. That idea has really helped us fine-tune the feedback loop and all of the different elements of our app. That has been definitely a learning since we launched.
Cool. All right, and we're at the back at the top now.
Should I just jump in then?
From your perspective, what's something either you've had to change or something you've learned that was a surprise or a pivot you've made since you first started working in this space?
Great, yeah. So, you know, when we launched Farfaria, we launched with, I think, we did kind of a soft launch with maybe 75 titles, and we were releasing, I think, 2 to 3 stories a week at the time. And we felt pretty good, but we knew we needed to grow our content base and kind of move faster. And we moved eventually up to 5 stories a week, and we felt like releasing new stories on a day-to-day basis was interesting and sort of like, you know, you get a new paper every day or you go to the web or, you know, your homepage, wherever you go, to Twitter and get the latest news every second, I guess, these days. And we weren't sure how kids would respond to that or how important that would be to them. But what we found is that it's actually tremendously important to them and it brings them back to the app more frequently because of the fact that there's a new story every day. And so, you know, we sort of, I think, guessed at it a little bit and seen that we thought we had something right. And then as we moved up to 5 stories a week, we've seen that it's definitely made a difference in getting kids to come back. And now they're using the product 4 to 5 days a week and reading, you know, a lot more than, you know, we certainly thought we could get them to read when we first started. So I think kids are reading more than 5 times the national average now in Farfaria. So we're really feeling good about the impact we're having on getting kids to read and getting them excited about reading. And I think a big part of that is the frequency.
Right. I'm wondering about your demographics. I know that for my kids, at certain periods in their lives when we were doing read aloud, you know, we tried to do read aloud every night. And, you know, about the 77th time I had to read Pokey Little Puppy, you know, I kind of wanted to die. And I'm wondering, is there that, is, are we still seeing those kinds of patterns where kids will latch into wanting to, you know, basically sort of wanting to do that story until, from, you know, whatever it is they're slurping out of it and steeping in it until they're done?
Yeah, you know, to some extent, yes, and to a large extent, no, also. I think the fact that we have, you know, we have an all-you-can-eat model, and so the child can read any story they want, and there isn't, you know, so can we buy this, or you know, do we have that book? That changes the game. And so the child, and because it's, the experience is designed for children to explore, and so they get to drive the decision-making around what book we read. And certainly they do that at home to some extent by choosing the books off the bookshelf, but they don't make quite the mess of the bookshelf, you know, the way they, you know, the way they do at home. And, you know, we see that there's, for instance, there's a story called Ashapattle and the Giant Sea Monster, and we were excited about the story when we launched, but it's been a massive hit, and kids keep going back to it and reading it over and over again. And I hear this about 2-year-olds up to 8-year-olds. They all like this story, and they'll want to read it again and again. But what I hear from parents that sort of eases the pain is that they'll want to read, you know, 2 to 3 stories a night, and or even more. And that'll, the one they want to read again and again will be one of the 3 or 4, and the other ones will all be new stories or stories they've read very infrequently. And so the parents getting more variety, less brain numbing, reading the same thing over and over again. And I think that's better for the child also, because the parents more engaged and excited about the story, I think that makes for a better storytelling experience.
Right. So and do you guys exert editorial control over those 5? You know?
We do. Yeah, we do. I mean, over our releases of the stories we have, yeah, we curate those titles. You know, we have an editor from Scholastic, and our creative director, our creative chief, is from Disney. And so, you know, we oversee a lot of the content's development, and that's why we work with a crowd of writers and illustrators. But we also work with publishers, and you know, we curate which titles we bring in from publishers as well. And the goal is to have a well-rounded collection. We try to get stories from all over the world, you know, classics that you've heard of, you may or may not have heard of, from Scotland, like Ashapattle, but also from India and Thailand and Native American stories and so forth. And that's all part of we consider to be sort of our mission is to broaden horizons and to offer great diversity through our product.
Cool. Okay, so I want to circle. We'll start with the middle, because we started from one end and went from the other, and now we'll go back to Gunal and Anna. Could you guys talk a little bit about your childhoods and specifically, what was reading as an experience for you growing up? Are there, you know, specific things around reading that were really pivotal and important to you, or was reading sort of something that you discovered at a later age? And how has that had an effect on, actually in your case, in drawing as well, storytelling and sharing? How has that had an effect on what you've done now that you're more grown up?
Well, how I grew up in, this is on, I grew up in Colombia. That's where I am from. And I actually moved around quite a bit, from Colombia to the States and then back. And reading for me, I guess, was a way to, it was the, I remember the first book that I loved was Jules Verne, Journey to the Center of the Earth, because it just opened a whole new world, which I guess is what the book was about. It was the first time I just got a kick out of living in, just imagining all of the different possibilities that could exist. And then as I grew up, it became, and I moved around to many different places, I guess it became a way for me, another way to understand new cultures where I was living. How it relates to drop, well, I see, as I mentioned earlier, Kunal, and I see drawing almost as a precursor to reading, because it's the first step that children take to interpreting the world that they see around them. you know, you move from drawing to a sequence of drawings. Those are the first books that children read, then you add text. And so what we're trying to focus on and drop is that aspect of exploration and understanding. So that resonates personally with me because it's the new weird thing that you're observing about where you are, whether you're in a certain place or you're at the zoo or wherever, we want to allow the child to capture all of the things that seem different and share them with the people who care.
Yeah, I think rather than calling it reading, we call it storytelling. You know, the act of creation and the act of sharing is I think a very clean and very simple and elegant description of storytelling. Right, you're creating an object and you're sharing it with someone, and that object, if it speaks to that person, and if you're with it and are interacting with it with them, then that is a story, right?
And you're communicating the meaning that you saw on that,
yes,
of whatever it is that you observed.
Absolutely. And how about you, Kuno? Anything for you growing up that has?
Sure. I mean, so the author that really stuck with me, and I, you know, still kind of cling to it, is Roald Dahl. And his book, Danny the Champion of the World, was by far my favorite book as I grew up, only because I think that was essentially the first time where I felt emotionally connected to a book and could A, relate to it, and B, felt like I didn't even know books could do that. You stir up so much of emotion to the point that you A, kind of think about it, and B, you know, it sticks with you through time. And to me, that was really like it opened my world to what reading can do for you. And, you know, as I think about what we do, I really think to like, what is it that I can do to play a role in building drop to the point that emotionally, the child has emotional ties or emotional connections to the conversations that he or she is having, the stories that they're telling. You know, that's one aspect of it. The second aspect is, I think that much like storytelling, Mary Poppins also really stuck with me. I still remember this. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but the song, which is the Chim Chimney song, I still remember them going up on the chimney and, having the umbrella and essentially, you know, flying away. And I think that just that element of magic which storytelling can bring and how it opens your mind to thinking of things which don't have to exist the way they do as we see it in the world today. You know, I mean, an umbrella doesn't have to be to for the rain. It can be to fly away. Or as Mary Poppins' hat comes up, you know, she pulled out a lamp from it. I still remember that scene. And those are the elements of magic which I think, kids need to hold on to. Kids need to know that it's possible to think beyond what's possible in the world today. And it's just that encouragement which I think storytelling brings, which is sticks on with me and I try to bring to drop.
Cool. Yeah, and by the way, big fan of Jules Verne, huge fan of Roald Dahl. I think that Roald Dahl had a shockingly pragmatic and beautifully nuanced view of the way the world works for children, right?
Exactly.
And so can write some extraordinarily, especially by, for example, American sensibilities, extraordinarily dark stuff that is just delightful for kids because it rings so true. You know, a lot of times when you're a kid and you hit the Roald Dahl age, life does feel kind of, you know, punitive and indiscriminate and random and bizarre, and the notion that there would be, you know, people like the Twits living next door, or you'd have live in a giant peach is of course, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah. All right. So, let's see. Who wants to go next?
This is Ajay.
Yeah.
All right.
Go for it.
Go, Ajay. You're on.
Okay, great. Thanks. So, so for me, I think it's growing up, books were like they were respected at a level that was that's almost hard to describe. Like it was just sort of the way we treated books was with great reverence, and reading was something I did every day, and certainly stayed up late with the book light under the covers and read. And but I feel like I stuck on picture books longer than most kids. I think I really enjoyed just staring at the pictures and trying to draw them myself. And so when we started on Farfaria, I was almost the most exciting part for me, although I love technology and love apps, was the stories. And so, we started with just a couple of people, and it was about, and I was editing and sort of doing some of the art direction, and it's just truly exciting for me to be that close to the content creation process and yet to handle it carefully, because we wanted to allow the illustrator and writer to express themselves. And so, you know, for me, that was, it just all, I think it all goes back to feeling like, you know, books are this tremendous opportunity. And now I feel like that's, you know, where we have a chance to really give more kids the opportunity to read and get excited about reading and to find, you know, to find reading fun, which I think some kids don't discover or not until later. And you know, we think we can do that a little bit earlier through our approach.
And did you do Tintin or?
It was kind of random for me. I think I remember, I mean, I guess the ones I gravitated towards were all the ones that are still very popular now, Where the Wild Things Are, Dr. Seuss books, you know, those, and then comic books as well. And the art of the comic books of, you know, whether it's DC Comics or whatever, like just really got into that and really excited about it when I was young.
Yeah, I pivoted quite strongly to comic books my freshman year in college or high school. And, you know, I had treasured my Tintins, which were just held together with book tape and were just trashed beyond belief. And were major treasures. You know, I might get one or two Tintin a year because they didn't sell them in my town. And I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire. You know, we did not have that kind of book accessible, right? So it happened, you know, happened to be if we were out visiting Dartmouth, we could get them like at the Dartmouth bookstore. And it was a huge deal for me. So so the pivot in that kind of storytelling into comic books was quite natural for me. And continued, you know, my love of writing while I, or reading and writing, while at the same time I was looking at, you know, The Lord of the Rings and a bunch of other much deeper, you know, more epic kinds of things.
Yeah, right. No, I'm definitely a big fantasy, Lord of the Rings, fantasy kind of guy as well myself. And I think for me it was a lot of time was just, I remember the library as being such an intense experience and like just that opportunity and there's the, just so much opportunity, kind of overwhelming and in a good way. And that's one of my like sort of fond, like visceral memories.
Yeah, I had the double whammy of sometimes in my summers before I started very early summer jobs, because we didn't have money. but before that, you know, the library on the boarding school I grew up on, the only building in the entire campus that was air conditioned was the library. So it was like a double draw. You know, I could sneak into the library, which I wasn't supposed to be into unsupervised, and then, you know, go down somewhere in the stacks and pull a bunch of books and hide and read for, you know, hours and hours and hours and get the double whammy of it not being hot and being able to read anything I want. Oh, it was fantastic. All right, how about you, Jason?
Yeah, so as I think about kind of the important pieces to sort of what was inspiring about my childhood that I'm trying to pull into to sort of Playtell as we kind of go down this path, is I think a lot about like driving like multi-sensory experiences. So how do we, you know, what were the things from childhood that like, you know, certainly I loved like Dr. Seuss and things like that, and I can totally relate to, you know, sitting there and trying to draw my own characters, whether they were from like picture books or later from comic books that I also enjoyed. You know, just like I loved kind of all of the things like puzzles and games and the books. And I think trying to figure out, is there sort of a consistent line where all of this content can help reinforce ideas and characters and sort of pull kids through some sort of, I'm going to use the word curriculum very lightly, just to like suggest like, you know, there is sort of a path from like a book to a game to a puzzle to a drawing, perhaps, just to keep them in, you know, sort of inspired and thinking creatively about some topic of interest for them for that particular week or day. Because I know very much like things would stick with me after I would, you know, read a book. You know, it might pop up the next day and I would just kind of hang on to that. And I think that's kind of interesting to see what your imagination can do when it just grabs one kernel and continues rolling with it.
Cool. So multi-sensory experiences and sort of the notion of, like, how do you expand on those and move them forward and make them as engaging as the experiences that you had growing up.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
I have to, you know, do the obligatory talk about some of the cool stuff that we're doing in this space. We actually have somebody mentioned curation. We have a web service that is in a developer preview called Curation, and it's designed to help people look at digital objects that are both in our own store, our own catalog, not store, our own catalog, as well as digital objects that are all sort of across the web, and use increasingly sophisticated tools to help help people source content from what is essentially an infinitely growing base of content and present it in ways that are a combination of reflecting sort of who we are and the way we want to represent ourselves in our blog or in our app or on our webpage or wherever our digital presence might be. At the same time, do so in a way that we think is going to appeal to sort of our people we like, our friends, our core constituencies, our customers, our readers, right? So that if we are, we cater to hipsters, then we're going to want to source stuff that is, you know, either supportive of or orthogonal to, but it does so in the notion of understanding what a hipster is and how we would curate a list of five great things to do for five great books to read, five great apps to run, five great movies to see, and be able to do it so that someone who's running a soccer mom experience or running a retired grandfather community or blog can do the same thing, right? Can source through this large quantity of possible things and then come up with the things that really are most best appropriate to present at any given time. I think that curation is, I mean, I've been looking at it, and I think a lot of what you guys are doing is very, very dedicated and really nuanced and beautiful curation, because some of it has to do with working with professionals who are creating content and then you're curating it, but it also has to do with the self-curation of self-derived works, like in the case of Drop, which I think is really cool because, among other things, it's going to help those kids become better curators themselves, better understand their understanders of what it is about what they're doing that's beautiful and great and valuable and interesting. So I want to close with an open question for everybody, and this is an open question we have asked more than once on this show, and that is I'm going to hand you a one-shot magic wand. The magic wand is preloaded with enough magical energy to perform a galactic-scale magic trick, but it only, because of the subtlety and the weirdness of the magic, can do something sort of in your domain, right? It's not going to solve world hunger. It's not going to solve the lack of internet connection to billions of people on the planet, but it can solve something, some gnarly hard problem, you know, in the large, writ large domain you're in, childhood reading, childhood education, childhood expression, and networking. We'll start, I think, from the top again, with you, Jason, and we'll just go down from there. You got a magic wand? What are you going to point it at?
And I assume we have genie rules here, so no two wishes, right? You only get the
correct
one wish. You can't wish for new wishes, right? Yeah, okay.
Correct. Yeah.
So Robin Williams rules, Aladdin rules.
Yes.
I think this idea of if every child could have access to education and the resources to really create a love of learning and have the tools to be able to be curious and find the answers to the things that they want to become passionate about. So just being able to kind of give a kid, and whether this means like a tablet, I mean, certainly I think that's how a lot of folks in tech are thinking now, but it could be anything, right? I mean, just some tool for curiosity. I want every kid to be able to have one and to have access to finding the answers to the things that they want to nerd out about.
Cool.
That can grow with them, right?
Right.
So it's sort of like a little modern R2-D2 unit that kind of helps them navigate the learning of what excites them.
Right. It's the primer from Diamond Age of Neal Stephenson.
Sure. Yeah, Diamond Age is a good one.
Cool. All right. Next up, we had Jason. Who's next? Ajay?
Sure. Yeah, just make sure I'm not on mute. Certainly the tablet, getting every kid a tablet is a great answer. I think what we're really excited about and in line with Farfaria is we would like to see every child have access to any story they want anytime, and we that's sort of a big part of our mission. But I also think it's an exciting concept. I think that. You were talking about curation. If I could read sort of the top X stories from different cultures, I think it'll open my eyes. I think if I can sort of understand the world from the eyes of its children, I think it sounds cheesy, but I also think it'd be pretty magical. And so I'd be excited about that.
Cool. All right. Anna.
Go ahead. I don't know if I had this fantastic magic. Okay, so I guess the problem I choose, and I don't know if this is a huge problem, but I certainly think it would be awesome. If I would love for mobile devices or just almost any device to be able to transmit feedback to the sense of smell, because it seems to me to be a very neglected sense at the moment. If you notice, we are talking about sharing and transmitting all this type of information, and we see and we hear this feedback to whatever it is that we produce. And the sense of smell, which I'm sort of tying together, sense of taste, someone's a little bit harder to get to, is very primal and strong, and I think it would be incredible if children, for example, could be reading a book and they could touch a flower and they could smell a little bit of that, because it's such a potent experience in real life. I have no idea how you would do this, so I think it would be a perfect opportunity to use this sort of magic that you described.
Yeah, I love it, because every attempt at making that work has sucked so bad that
I know
it clearly needs magic.
Exactly.
All right, Kunal, you're up.
So one of the things that really has stuck with me as we've been doing what we're doing is something which actually Jeff Bezos said when he announced the Kindle Fire. It's like they're in the business of building experiences and not or services and not, hardware products. And I really got to thinking a lot about that night. And, something that I would do with this magical wand is really like, to me, it's really about merging this physical and digital world to the point that they coexist and reverberate off each other. And you're building experiences that last, not products that last, not devices that last. It really is that no matter which device I go to, my experience is something which I take to every place I go. For example, we have a tablet. Sure, why can't I take it to the zoo and actually have an experience which really tailors itself to the animals that I see? And give me tools which I can enhance my experience at the zoo, because that's the kind of stuff that's possible today with location devices, with the ability to touch things, to put your camera up and actually see, augment reality. And I think that really merging these two worlds in a way that creates a playground, which is almost like, adds a new dimension to it, so that the playground which kids love to go to McDonald's now exists every single where. It's what I'm going to remember regardless of whether I'm in the car, at a restaurant, at home, at school. It's that new dimension that makes me really relate to these experiences in a way that takes it to a new level.
Yeah, that one is something that's really important to me, because my concern is that a lot of the ground, what is considered to be groundbreaking work and highly profitable work that is happening in that space of I don't want to call it augmented reality, because it's kind of a overused and not understood term right now. But in the notion of having at your fingertips, the contextually appropriate for you, little seeds, kernels, nuggets of data.
I think
it's incredibly powerful. My big concern is that it becomes an opportunity to monetize before it becomes an opportunity to delight. And
right.
Imagine if rather than saying the first 100 things you're going to tell someone about a new experience that, a new city that they're visiting, imagine if you said you're going to spend 100 of those precious interaction payloads on just trying to make the person happy, just trying to make them better educated, just trying to make them feel like they understand where they are and have a better sense of the world and they're a little bit better, happier, more informed person, and you're going to do 100, and it's only going to be the 101st when you're going to try to tell them that there's a great restaurant around the corner or somebody's running a special on, cappuccinos after 2 o'clock. That represents a real shift in the way we think about how we present and source data for our users. And I think that if I could wave my magic wand, I get to ask myself that question. I was going to say shop class, because I think that shop class is a hugely missing attribute in teaching people how to think about the creation and development of the experiences that they may be using, and in particular the tools they can use to create the experiences that we're all talking about. Especially with the whole maker movement. But I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say the most important thing, if I had my magic wand, I would point it at, would be that I want an augmented reality primer, whatever it is, satellite-fed magic, super awesome thing that whenever I'm standing in front of something, it does a really good job of figuring out what it is that I want to know about it and can tell me the difference between staring at a fire hydrant, knowing that I did a research project 6 months ago about iron foundries in New England, so it's going to tell me that this fire hydrant was poured by the first iron foundry in Schenectady, New York, versus telling me that, the last dog that peed in this fire hydrant was a border terrier, and that's my favorite kind of dog. Whatever you want to geek out about around that, around the world, around your world and in your world, giving you an opportunity to just dig and dig and dig and become more and more informed about what's going on and what's interesting, I think it would be huge. I think it would be totally amazing. So, all right, great. So I think we're ready to wrap up. I'll give everybody a chance if you want to mention anything else. I'll do a roll call so we can make sure that as we close up, we get everybody's name and follow up. If there's any, here's your open chance. A question you were dying for me to ask that I didn't ask that you can answer right now. You got 2 minutes.
I guess I got a question for you guys. Given that it's National Reading Month, what books are you guys reading right now?
That's a great. I love it when people. I will. I am not reading a book. I am listening to the Code Accelera series by Jim Butcher. We're on the last book, read by Kate Redding. It's phenomenal. I highly recommend it, especially sourced via Audible. It's a rollicking good time.
Awesome.
I'm sort of off and on again with. I'm rereading The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Junot Diaz. I read it a few years ago, loved it, and then decided I didn't really fully absorb it well enough, so I went back to read it again and enjoying it tremendously again, but getting pulled away into other things too often.
I've been... No, you go ahead, please.
I'm reading The Fish That Ate the Whale, the story of Sam Samurai. And he was one of the presidents of United Fruit, and his story is crazy. It's filled with really, I find, impressive things and dreadful things, but it's a monumental life.
I've been reading Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. It was just it was like one of those freebies in the Amazon store, and I was like, I should pick that up and read that. But and then my sort of more businessy reading has been The Art of Game Design. It's been an interesting one that I've been picking up. And then Peter, you just made me want to go back and reread Diamond Age with your last comment.
Yeah, it's a good book.
So, yeah, good read.
Interesting. Right, I have the Benjamin Franklin book on my Kindle as well. It definitely is a good read.
Did we miss anyone? Cool. I think we got everyone. All right. So thank you all. Fantastic guests. I like this format. It worked incredibly well, and I know that that is in biggest part because we had some very good, strong domain experts. We had Ajay Gadwani from Farfaria. We had Anna and Kunal from Moondrop. Ajay can be found on Twitter at Farfaria or at Ajay Gadwani. Anna and Kunal can be found on Dropit, DRAWPIT. Jason, you are Moondrop. Did I get your Twitter handle? Did I ever ask that? Yes, here we go. At Playtel.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and right. At Jason DePero. And did I miss anybody? Did not miss anybody. All right, great. Thank you very much. My closing shout out to my listeners is go read a book to a kid. There's absolutely nothing better you could possibly do, having listened to this show, than pick up a book and read it to a kid. And if you don't have kids, I guarantee you that if you're over the age of 21, there are adults in your life who are reading books to kids every day who would kill to have you come over and read books to their kids, either at night or on the weekends. And so go read a book to a kid. You will indelibly make the world a better place, make some kids happy, and those are good things. I am Peter Biddle. This was Adam Mashing / Mashup Radio, and thank you very much for joining us for another great show.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Mashup Radio with Peter Biddle. Tune in next time.